CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Joseph Ellis. The cause is the book, The American Revolution and Its Discontents, 1773 to 1783. It is now 83, December of 83. Washington departs from Francis Tavern and then from the Congress in Maryland. Washington's off the stage. So, looking around at the remains of the day, let us begin in London. Several generals are looking at each other. Who to blame? Gage in Boston? Howe at the Battle of Long Island? Burgoyne, who was not reinforced at Saratoga? Clinton, who obeyed his orders and stayed in Philadelphia and New York? Cornwallis, who was trapped at Yorktown? Who do we blame, Professor? Was there one man more than any other?
Well, when you lose a war, and this is something I think we can see in American history quite frequently, the first instinct is to search for scapegoats. And scapegoats are effective because if you identify a single person or persons, you don't have to rethink the fundamental issues that got you into the war in the first place. In this case, they try to blame the generals. If you wanted to find somebody who is really more than a scapegoat, you'd have to point to George III. But you can't accuse George III within British politics, because that is to accuse the British Empire itself. And that is avoided. So they don't go after Cornwallis, but they go after all the other generals. And they go after Germain, who was probably bisexual. And they begin to notice that in the papers. And he dies a few years later, but he's regarded as the man who lost America.
We come to the American side of the story. And when Washington looked at the map that John Jay had amazingly created one summer's evening in France, he saw all the way to the Mississippi, this bounty, this empire. He owns 30,000 acres already in what was West Virginia into the Ohio River Valley. However, he overlooks the fact that it's occupied by 100,000 human beings, the Native Americans. And they've already made war on the Iroquois Nation. So what is the opinion of the Confederation Congress, 83 to 85, towards the Native Americans, Professor?
The official position of the Congress, and later on Washington will show he doesn't agree with all this, but at that time, that the Native Americans are a conquered people, that the Iroquois sided with the British. Of course, many other tribes didn't, but they have no rights at all. It's a very Eurocentric view of the situation. And so that you can begin to see Indian removal taking hold, even though officially doesn't happen until 1830 under Jackson. The origins and the rationale for it is present right at the end of the war. It's quite clear that the way it's going to play is that instead of going to war with them, we're going to simply allow the demographic wave of settlers coming, pursuing their happiness across the Alleghenies, all carrying diseases which the Native Americans have no immunity to. And it's like a terrible barrage of viruses. And that's how Indian removal is going to start. Washington himself, later during his presidency, is going to say, we cannot let this happen this way. He makes a bold effort to avoid it, but he fails. But the nation at the beginning cannot imagine doing anything other than taking the Indians' land from them.
Were the Oneida tribe that sided with the colonists, were they spared?
They were given an exception. They were they're one of the few of the Iroquois Confederation to side with them, and they have some casinos up there to remind us of that. And Grasshopper, their chief, was invited to be a guest at the surrender ceremony at Yorktown. They suffered a lot because by siding with the Americans, they were almost annihilated by the Mohawk tribe and the other Iroquois nations. But they're the exception within the Iroquois Confederation.
The loyalists. There were 60,000 loyalists who left when the British left, but there were 400,000 who stayed behind. You say that we're just beginning to get good scholarship about the loyalists and who they were. Is that correct?
There's a lot of people paying attention to the loyalists over the last 5 to 10 years, but mostly to the ones who leave, because they're the ones who leave the records They go to Nova Scotia. They go to back to England. They go to the Caribbean. There's about 8,000 to 10,000 African-Americans in that group. Most of them get sent, to Nova Scotia, some to Florida, some to Jamaica. The group that I'm calling attention to in the book at this point is all those people that didn't leave, that they moved out of their one-time town or village. Some of them went across the Alleghenies in pursuit of new land, but a lot of them just stayed, and if they were forgiven or their children were forgiven. And so they were like people in the congregation, declared sinners, who were allowed back into the congregation. Unlike the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution, there's no firing squad wall or guillotine. The ultimate punishment for most loyalists was banishment, and for most of the majority of them, eventual forgiveness.
The slaves. Jefferson writes in 1781 in Notes on the State of Virginia, 1785, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just," speaking of slavery. Now, 1777, Vermont banned slavery. 1779, New Hampshire banned slavery. 1783, Massachusetts banned slavery. 1780, Pennsylvania bans it. 1784, Rhode Island bans it. 1784, Connecticut bans it. New York and New Jersey do not until the next century. But there was a momentum. There was a wave. It stopped at Virginia. Why? What slowed it down, Professor?
Well, the sheer numbers. The numbers in all of those states that you mentioned are small. Only 10% of the enslaved population is in the North, in the northern states. 90% is in Virginia and South. Virginia could go either way at this moment, but you're right to say that at the end of the war, as you're standing astride that moment, the cause itself, it is clear, and everybody recognizes this, including slave owners like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, et cetera, this cause is incompatible with slavery. Nobody disagrees with that. And can we live with a contradiction? And it looks like the answer is going to be no. It looks like they're going to find a way to gradually end slavery, certainly in the North. And there's movement that way in Virginia, too. For the first time, slave owners can free their own slaves without permission from the state. Number of free blacks in Virginia is going way up. At the end of the slave trade, it is going to happen. Slavery is prohibited from expansion into the Ohio Territory, but it's not going to go that way. And one of the great failures of the founding is the failure to put slavery on the road to extinction. There seems to me to have been a moment then. It's what one great historian, David Brian Davis of Yale, once said, the perishability of revolutionary time. The time to do it was there. They thought they had more time than they did. They thought slavery might die a natural death. But without question, the supreme tragedy of the revolution is a failure to end slavery and put it on the road to extinction. And beneath the surface of the issue of slavery, I think, is the issue, what happens when you free it? And on the answer to that, I would say 80 to 90% of the white population of the United States could not imagine a biracial society at that time.
The book is The Cause, The American Revolution and Its Discontent, 1773 to 1783. Again, I read Thomas Jefferson, 1785. "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.